You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Shows. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Today, I'm going to have two segments. I'm going to have an update on the Obamacare. And the president today gave a speech in Boston. I have not had time to listen to it. I was in a meeting where I saw the president giving the speech, and they had some headers at the bottom. Apparently, he's promoting it as that everyone will have a much, much better health plan, and when they leave their employment, they can take it with them. Well, there's a number of problems with that I'll get into, because the problem is not the benefits in the plan. The problem is the price of the plan. Most people are getting rate increases of anywhere from 25 to 100% or more. And combined with the sticker price shock of the plans that they're forcing is the right word, Americans to buy, and limiting their choice, is the high deductibles. And so the issue is really consumer sovereignty and government intervention in the marketplace, which I'll discuss, and I'll probably go into a little bit more detail tomorrow after I have a time to really look into exactly what the president says. But the thrust from the comments that I was seeing scrolling down is the president think this is just the metal plans, the bronze, silver, gold, and platinum are much, much better plans, because they include a lot of services that your current plans don't have. Yeah, because you know why? It's like buying a car. I don't buy a fully loaded car. And that's what we're talking about. And see, that's the problem when you have government intervention into the marketplace. You have a bunch of bureaucrats and lawyers primarily in Washington, D.C., making decisions as to what you should buy and what we think should be in the plan. They think you're too stupid to go shop for health insurance. So I'll get into an overview of that. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. What I really want to focus in on, though, is the Benghazi situation, because I think it's about ready to pop. I don't know. I really expected it by now, that subpoenas would be flying and a number of people would be forced by a subpoena to testify either in the Senate and or the House. So I'll be getting on the Benghazi scandal or cover-up, and I'll sort of review it briefly. So it'll be somewhat of a short, abbreviated show. Like I said, I was tied up in a meeting, and I was tied up really editing and finishing off several articles. The good news is, because I'm somewhat ahead, I already have the stories done for the next 4 weeks, so I can really focus in on the radio show. Because even though the articles that I'm preparing, like one of them is on Benghazi, that hopefully will be in the next issue of the paper, and the two more that are coming up are on fiscal insanity and fiscal responsibility, and I need to at least make a bulletin on that just before. I checked earlier this afternoon while I was checking to see whether or not the U.S. Treasury Department publishes their monthly MTS report, which was late. It's normally due out the 8th business day. And, well, while it's not completely unusual for that report to be delayed, the October report includes the end of year numbers, the end of the fiscal year numbers for 30 September. The October report gives you the numbers for September, and we had record tax collections of over $300 billion, which is good news. That means the economy, more people are employed, so you're going to get more taxes. I really think we're still on the verge of a recession, though. And I think you're seeing it in your gas prices, because demand for gasoline is down. The supply is way up, and the demand for gasoline is way down. And as a result, you usually see that when the economy is in a recession. If you go back and look at a chart of oil prices, you'll see where you've had the most drop declines in prices invariably. These charts usually, not only do they plot gasoline prices, but they also have these gray bars where there are recessions. And because oil prices are very, not 100%, but it's a good predictor where a recession is, because just about either just a little bit before or right when you're in a recession, you'll see dramatic drop in prices of oil. And why? Because the demand for oil worldwide is going down. We have a lot of supply and we have less demand because the economies are not booming. So we've had some good news in the sense that the deficit for this year, for the first time, will be over $600 billion. I don't have the exact number in my head, but and that's the lowest it's been since Obama has been in office. It's still much higher than George Bush's last complete fiscal year, which was fiscal year 2008, when it was, in round numbers, $459 billion. So we're still not back to the highest deficit that Bush had. As a matter of fact, we're slightly less than $200 billion more than that. But this is good news. Now, why is that happening? Now, here's the irony. It's because of the sequester. And that's the one thing that the Democratic Party, including the president, wants to negotiate and get rid of. And as far as I'm concerned, the Republican Party would be foolish to do that. They should insist on the sequester, because that's the only thing, frankly, that's controlling spending at all. And you're gradually seeing the results. The problem, ladies and gentlemen, while you might celebrate a deficit, a budget deficit of over $600 billion, you really shouldn't be, because that's out of control. We need to balance the budget, and not necessarily in 1 year, but over a 3 or 4 year period. So we have some good news, higher than expected tax collections, slightly lower spending in September, resulting in a deficit of a little over $600 billion, which is progress. I'll be honest, I was surprised. I was fully expecting a deficit of right around $900 billion. I was predicting that we'll have revenues, again, round numbers, of $2.7 billion, and it was. I think it's $2.73 billion. So I was right on the money, or nearest billion, 2.7 on the revenue side. But I really thought that the spending would be about $900 billion more. In other words, about 3.6. I believe it came in at 3.4. So that's the good news. That's surprisingly good news. But now's not the time to give up, snatch victory, and turn it into defeat. And that could happen. I don't put anything past either the Democratic or the Republican Party. I truly think, though, the Republican Party, especially in the House and to a lesser extent in the Senate, are going to dig in their heels and not agree to anything that will change the sequester. Now, there are people in the House that want to negotiate, and that's my only feel. They shouldn't, because just let the sequester, which is, they were forced to do the sequester. And the sequester idea came from the White House. Don't forget that. And it's forcing cuts in spending, discretionary spending. The problem that some neoconservatives largely have, a lot of the cuts are in defense spending. And a lot of cuts are also in welfare programs that the Democrats don't want. But as far as I'm concerned, the only fiscal discipline that we have seen out of Washington is that sequester and the budget cap-related budget caps. And I would say, barring actually cutting spending or balancing the budget, which neither party has shown much inclination to do, I think this is going to be the best we have. So it would be very, very foolish on the part of the Republican Party to agree to a deal. And quite frankly, I don't think the Democrats have much to offer that would be enticing. Now, after saying all that, I know that there's some in the Republican Party, the neoconservatives and their friends, that want to increase defense spending a lot. And they don't like the sequester because it hits defense the hardest. But that's where the money's at. It's very simple. That and entitlements. See, what really needs to happen, ladies and gentlemen, is so-called entitlement reform. But that's a non-starter because the Democrats have made very clear they don't want to negotiate that at all. And entitlements are Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Those are the big three. And I should say Obamacare, too. That's an entitlement program. And the big driver is and to a lesser extent, Medicaid. And so in terms of where the money's at and where the cuts need to be in benefits, and what they're going to be doing is changing the eligibility for people for both Medicare and Social Security. I think the fix is going to be this. They are going to increase the age when you can start receiving Medicare benefits. Now, they're going to do it gradually, but I think what you're going to see, it's going to move up to 66, 67, 68, 69, and 70 over several decades. And that will definitely help in terms of reducing the so-called unfunded liabilities. And it needs to be done. Because right now, with Medicare, you qualify when you turn 65. And most baby boomers that are the leading edge of the baby boomers have already hit 65. Most of them, the leading edge is 66, 67. They're largely between 65 and 67. And they've retired. If they wanted full benefits at age 66, they were entitled to Social Security. And when they hit 65, they're entitled to Medicare. Now, some baby boomers will retire early, and you can collect Social Security as early as 62, but you take a significant cut, like 30%, in the benefits. Most people wait to 66 or 67, depending on when they're born. And the reason I get into this, that's really where the problem is. It's mandatory. In my mind, you got several areas for cutting spending. But where the money's at and where the most savings can be had is in mandatory spending, and specifically the entitlement programs, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Now, that doesn't mean there are not other areas that need to be cut, including social income security programs such as food stamps and unemployment compensation. And there are Republicans that want to cut it. The problem is that's, again, a non-starter. The Democratic Party does not want to do it. You know, the thinking is, well, there could be some trade-offs or gives and takes in terms of defense versus income security and entitlement programs. But you need two to tango. You need both parties need to be willing and able to negotiate. And I don't see it at all in terms of the Democratic Party. The president doesn't want to do it. The Senate leadership doesn't want to do it. And the leadership in the House is the same way in terms of the progressive Democrats. They think by waiting us out that they can win the election in 2014 and again in 2016. And if they can push comprehensive immigration reform through, that they will get more and more Democratic voters. So they're just biding their time. And they might be right. That's what's really scary. Because if you actually look at the numbers, government spending is out of control. Even with before Barack Obama, if any president had a deficit of over $600 billion, all your media, especially if it was a Republican president, would be on his case. That's out of control. Not with Obama in office. They're going to applaud that as he's actually cut the deficit. And yeah, it was at 1.4, fiscal year 2009, 1.4 trillion was the deficit. And in 10, it was 1.3. 11, it was slightly under 1.3, then slightly under 1.1 trillion. And now we're a little over 600 billion. So I like the trend line. The problem is it's just not enough. We need drastic. The sooner that federal spending is cut and the budget is balanced, the better. Because that's what it's going to take to really encourage economic growth. Because right now, anyone thinking about starting a business or forming a business or someone already in business thinking about growing it. Their concern is the uncertainty that's coming out of Washington in a number of areas, one being healthcare cost, because what's getting in the news today is the website, which I think will be eventually cleaned up and operational. I really don't think it's going to be there for 6 months. It's going to improve, but it's still having problems as we speak, because it takes, even if you recruit the so-called best and brightest to fix it, it takes a lot of time. You have over 5 million lines of code. So it takes time to really learn what's going on, what are the mistakes, and then you got to fix them and then test the fix. We're talking months, not necessarily years, but months. And I think it's very optimistic to think that by the end of November, remember, Friday's November 1st, that all this is going to be solved. I would be very, very surprised if that's the case. Very surprised. So the website is, as far as I'm concerned, the least of the administration's problems. Now, that's getting all the attention, and the Secretary of Human Resources apologized to Congress for her incompetence in really managing this program. But she was, in essence, the punching bag for the day. She had her marching orders to take her lumps, let them hit you, we'll support you, and the best you're going to get is an apology. The problem is what they've forced on the American people is not what they want. American consumers first and foremost want choice. We are a nation of consumers. We're one of the most prosperous countries in the world. And you can see that by going into any grocery store, clothing store, hardware store, any type of retail outlet. And what do you see? You see choice in a host of products. Now, yes, many of those products are produced abroad. I understand that. But that is what the American people have come to expect. American people are looking for bargains. They're looking for sales. They're looking for items on discounts. I'm a very, you know, I don't really shop a lot. The one thing I do buy is books. And I have changed my buying patterns because I'm somewhat on, at least temporarily, on a limited budget. So when I buy books, most of the books I buy are $1 or less. I go to half-price books. And I seldom buy, and just so if you're not familiar with half-price books, they have a number of stores throughout Texas in the Dallas area, but their headquarters and their main store is not too far from where I live. I used to actually live closer to it. I was one of their big customers. Not anymore. I don't consider a big customer anymore. But when I buy books, and I do buy books there, I only spend a dollar or less. And I usually have a coupon that I get and get 15% off. So a book typically, even with tax, costs me less than a dollar. So for 20 bucks, you can get 20 books. A lot of people are not readers. I'm a reader. I like to read. And if I see good books on sale, even if I might not read it today or even next month, I know at some point I will, and I can save some money. Now, people do that for various things. It could be videos. It could be clothes. It could be shoes. It could be even cars. The American people are consumers. They're shoppers, and they're looking for bargains. And they expect a range of prices. And they don't like to be told what they have to buy. Now, this is my lead up into my first segment on Obamacare. And I've had several shows now I've touched upon it, and this is really an update. I'm not going to really get into the whole Obamacare mess other than to say that the real problem with Obamacare is not the website, even though that's getting the most publicity now. The real problem with Obamacare, it really limits your freedom of choice as to what you can buy for health insurance. And from the little of the excerpts that I caught that Obama's on his speech, he's sort of missing the point. And the point is this. Yes, they've added a number of what they call essential benefits that all health insurance plans need to have. I'm not interested in maternity care. I'm not interested in psychiatric care. I'm not interested in obesity care. I'm not interested in drug counseling. All those benefits are contraceptives. All of those benefits are now in the health plan. Some bureaucrat, some lawyer, some good-intentioned person has put the required essential benefits in these plans. And they really thought they did the right thing. There's only one problem. I don't want to buy them. And I certainly don't want to pay for them. And that's part of the problem. You have the federal government and a bunch of bureaucrats deciding for every American consumer what should be in their health insurance plan. That's problem number one. And people are resenting it because, one, they don't want it and they can't afford it. But that's only a small part of the problem. And that's what the president is trying to sell. You're going to have much better coverage. This is terrific. You're going to love it. No mention of the prices, though. No mention of the deductibles that most people simply can't afford. And see, what's going to happen is some people believe, and it's their money, that they got to get something, and they will get one of these plans. And then they're going to discover, and there's discovering already, that if they ever need health care, that before they can get it, they're going to have to pay a significantly higher deductible than their current plans. And when I'm talking 5, 10, 15 times higher than their existing plan. Because most plans today, individual, you have 100, 250, 500, 750, 1,000, some 2,000 or 2,500. That's more or less the range. Somewhere between $100 to $2,500. Not these plans. Most of these plans are $3,500 to $6,000 deductibles. And that's per person. It's not husband and wife. It's not a family deductible. That's for each adult. And then here's the problem. Most people that went out and took the trouble to find a plan that met their needs, they were satisfied with, probably didn't have all the benefits that our president is really, aren't these plans terrific? Now they're finding it's going to cost them 50% more in premium or 100% more in premium. And then even if they can afford that, and many can't, if they ever get sick and need health care services, benefits, they're going to have to pay, in addition to the premium, that deductible, and it's quite high. And most people simply won't be able to write that check, a $5,000 or $6,000 deductible check. And most hospitals and doctors are going to insist on, yeah, I see you got your silver or bronze or gold plan, but you got to pay me the deductible before I provide you the service. And if you can't do it, guess what? Sucks to be you. See, that's the problem, ladies and gentlemen. It's sticker shock, the significantly higher premium, and those deductibles. Now, what's really, though, behind the why the premium so high? Part of it is these additional benefits. That some of you, hey, listen, if you're just starting out, you want maternity. That's fine. There are plenty of plans today that include maternity, but they're more expensive. Or let's say you have a drug problem and you want drug counseling or psychiatric care. So for you, it's good. But here's the problem. There are people with so-called pre-existing conditions, and these are serious pre-existing conditions, such as cancer, heart disease, strokes. And if you've had one of these and still have one of these so-called pre-existing conditions, it was difficult and expensive to get health insurance if you could get it. And what most people had to do that were in that situation was to buy it from a state special risk pool. And it was not cheap. I'll be the first to say it was not cheap. But that was really your only alternative, because most individual coverage, not group, but individual coverage, was medically underwritten. By the new law, they can't do that. They can't ask you medical questions. No more medical questions. I didn't say financial questions, but medical questions. Because they're checking up on how much you make through the IRS and to determine the subsidies. So yes, one of the winners, or one group of winners, are people that have serious pre-existing conditions that meant they were either paying a lot of money to have health insurance if they could get it, or they didn't have health insurance. So they are probably the big winner. But here's the problem. That is not a large percentage. There are a lot of people that have pre-existing conditions. For example, high blood pressure. But it's the seriousness and the nature of the pre-existing condition that really determines, at least prior to Obamacare, whether A, you could get coverage, and if you could, how much was it rated up? You know, for example, let's say you were a smoker and had high blood pressure. Well, you could get coverage, but it's going to cost you more money. Now, with Obamacare, individual coverage, and you needed, and I will talk a little bit more beyond individual coverage. I need to talk about the business market as well. But with individual coverage, where in the past they had to ask medical questions, can't do it anymore if you're buying individual. Who gets hurt are the overwhelming majority of people that do not have a pre-existing condition. That is the major driver and the principal reason people are seeing 25, 50, 100% increases in their premium. And when you combine that with all these benefits, so-called essential benefits have to be in the plan. And there are some insurance plans out there that have them, but many of them don't. They don't have all of them. They might have one or more that are not included. Because what, you know, insurance companies, they're a business. They're to make a profit, and they will specialize in certain markets or certain niches of the insurance industry. It could be some will be individual, some will be small group, some will be large group, and they'll design plans. You know, for example, I know that if you buy a plan that covers psychiatric care, in other words, you got to see a psychiatrist either every week or every month or whatever, and you're almost never cured. You keep going, 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 and going. That's expensive. And yes, there are insurance plans out there even today that include it, but they're expensive relative to plans that, for example, don't cover that or don't cover drug rehabilitation or counseling. See, Americans want to choose what they need and want. There's no one plan that really fits all people. And to a certain extent, that is what Obamacare is doing. It is very much narrowing your freedom of choice, your consumer sovereignty as to what you can purchase by standardizing what is in these plans. But the problem they had when they did this is that they're not going to ask any questions, and that's forbidden by law. That is why many of your plans have been canceled. It's illegal to do that anymore. Now, there's another point I need to raise, but I want to make sure you understand that the primary reason why those premiums are going higher and higher, it's not because of the insurance company. It's the fact that the government says all the insurance carriers, A, can't ask any questions, which means there's no pre-existing conditions anymore. And the insurance company knows what's going to happen. Who do you think are going to be the first ones in line to sign up for Obamacare? All the people that have pre-existing conditions, serious ones. And all the people that, let's say, have medical insurance, that's very expensive. That's what insurance companies call adverse selection. It's the sickest people that are going to rush in and sign up. And it's only logical. A, they need it. They know they're going to have claims, big ones. And it's probably, in most cases, if not all cases, going to be significantly cheaper than what they were paying if they had insurance. So those will be the first ones to really take advantage of Obamacare. Now, what the insurance companies are counting on is they capture a large percentage, if not 100%, a large percentage of young people, 18 to 29, that don't have medical problems, don't have pre-existing condition problems, and they know that actuarially their demand for health care is going to be significantly less than either people with pre-existing conditions, people that are sick, and people that are elderly. And they're forcing young people to buy health insurance. And why initially you might get a subsidy, once you start working, you're going to be paying a stiff penalty because it is a function of your income. After 3 years, by 2016, you will pay a penalty of 0.5%. So the more money you make, the more the penalty is. And that's to force you to buy health insurance. And that's your choice. You either pay the penalty or buy health insurance. The problem is, for most young people, it's significantly higher. The only ones that benefit are those that are poor or dirt poor and those that have pre-existing conditions. And why do I say that? Well, if you're earning no income then or very little income, you qualify for Medicaid. And again, that is a lot of the people that are registering and actually enrolling in the plans today are not enrolling in either the bronze, silver, gold, or platinum plans. What are they enrolling in? They're enrolling in Medicaid, which has always been available, I mean, for years. Those are the major, a large percentage of all the people that are so-called signing up. That's what they're signing up for. They could do that prior to this. What the government needs to do, or this whole this house of cards, this bad idea whose time will end shortly, is going to collapse. Why? If the young people don't enroll and don't pay the penalties, which I frankly recommend, I'm recommending civil disobedience, because most of you can't find a job. That's why your income is low, and one of the reasons you can't find a job is because of Obamacare. So the sooner Obamacare is repealed, the better. Unfortunately, at the earliest that could happen would be in 2017. And let's be realistic here, ladies and gentlemen, it'll probably be 2018. That's 5 years from now. And I say that because only if the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the presidency will you get a repeal bill voted upon, passed, and then signed by a president. Do you really think Barack Obama would not veto any attempt by the Republicans in the House and Senate? Let's say in 2014 that the Republicans not only keep control of the House but get an extra 30 seats. And let's assume that they not only capture the Senate, let's go all the way. Let's say they got a veto-proof Well, not veto-proof. They would need 60 votes in the Senate to get it, I believe, veto-proof. They can overturn. I might be wrong on that. My point is this. President Obama was going to, if that happened, and the earliest it could happen is 2015, because the election is approximately a year away, and they wouldn't take office until early January of 2015. And it's going to take some time to repeal Obamacare. But if the Senate and the House were both controlled by Republicans and a bill were passed, President Obama is repealing Obamacare. President Obama is going to veto it. So unless they have enough of a majority in both houses to overturn that veto, which I think is remote that they will, that's why I say the earliest Obamacare will be repealed is 2017, and more like 2018, because it does take time to do that. So we're stuck with this disaster for at least four years. And yes, there are people that gonna swear by it. Listen, all the people on Medicaid, they're largely Obamacare supporters. Why? They're dependent on the government for welfare. Food stamps, subsidized housing, supplemental income. They're the poor. So they're going to be on Medicaid. They're not going to get one of these plans. They're not. In addition to that, you have people that are not may have a part-time job, may have a full-time job, but are low income and will qualify for some subsidies that will, to a certain extent, not entirely, because this is a sliding scale. The more you make, listen up close, the more you make, the less subsidies you're going to get. That's the way it works. It's a function of a percentage of the poverty line. And at some point, if you're successful in making money, you don't qualify for the subsidy. And that's what you want. You see, the best situation is you have a good-paying job where you're not dependent upon the government. And you can buy what you want. But the problem, ladies and gentlemen, Obamacare really radically narrows your range of choice in terms of the number of companies and the types of plans you can buy. And even if you don't buy individual coverage, but your employer provides it as an employee benefit where you work, it's going to be expensive there. So he's paying for it. You know, he could have given you that as money, then you buy your own. You see, I'm not really a big fan of group coverage in this sense. I think just like life insurance, disability insurance, car insurance, homeowners insurance, renter's insurance, individuals should spend their own money and go out and buy what they want. I'm consistent in that. And you shouldn't be stuck with an employer's plan that, for whatever reason, you're not satisfied with. You see, there are many employer plans that are very, very good. And when you look at the price, because sometimes most employers provide for the employee, not necessarily the spouse, but for the employee, pay 100%. What I usually ran into, that for most employers that I at least dealt with, they would pay 100% of the employee's medical insurance. They provided that as an employee benefit. And if they wanted coverage for their spouse or their children, they were either going to have to pay for it entirely out of their paycheck, or the employer might subsidize it. For example, they'll pay half and you pay the other half. And here's the problem. Just like the individual plans, the choice is narrowed, and it has narrowed. A lot of insurance companies have got out of this market. They're not going to provide either the bronze, silver, gold, platinum, the so-called metal plans or the tiers. So you're going to have fewer insurance carriers to go to and fewer plans to look at. And see, that is going against, and that's why I started this segment, what most Americans want. Americans want to shop. They want a range, a broad range of choices. They want to tailor any product to their needs. What do they truly need? What do they want? And most importantly, what can they afford? So why I applaud the effort to go to an individual plan that's portable. In other words, you're not trapped in a job. You have your own coverage. And if you're dissatisfied with your pay or job situation, you can move to another employer. That's what's great about America. It's choice, consumer sovereignty, not government sovereignty or monopoly. It's consumer sovereignty where you have a range of choices from businesses in the private sector. You're not locked in to a very narrow choice of health insurance plans, which is exactly what is happening now. Now, what you need to understand, that many of the people pushing this Obamacare, including the president, including the Democratic Party, including so-called progressives, they don't even want this. They want the government to have a monopoly on your health insurance, so-called single payer. And the single payer is the government, where in essence, you have no choice. You're stuck. It's the government plan or nothing. And they would outlaw private insurance. And there's only two countries that do that, Canada and North Korea. But Canada, the people of Canada, if they really need something treated, where do they come? They come to the United States. And some of them will go abroad, but mainly to the United States. Because in other countries, even where you have a single-payer system, you can buy with your own money insurance and be treated by doctors and hospitals that will take that. But what the people in power in the Democratic Party and the Progressive Caucus and President Obama truly want, they just simply don't have the votes to get it through, is a single payer. I call that the lead plan. And if we ever get to a lead plan, you won't have all these choices. They will say, this is your plan. If you don't like it, tough. And if you have a procedure that we won't authorize, you're out of luck. And for many of you, that'll kill you. You see, the people that really get hurt here in the long run are the elderly. Because what they're going to really clamp down on, even with Obamacare, is hip replacements, knee replacements, and cataract surgery, which are the three of several of the top procedures elderly people, typically in their 60s, 70s, or 80s, need. Their eyesights go, they get cataracts, and they need surgery for it. And if you don't get the surgery, you become blind. And if you don't get the hip replacement, it's hard to move. If you don't get the knee replacement, it's hard to walk. In other words, the death panels are coming, they're actually here. And that's what's going to happen if you have single payer, and that single payer is the United States government. That's not going to be a good plan, folks. But that's what they're trying. They're selling the American people a bill of goods. Now, what the American people remember, when George Bush said, read my lips, no new taxes. Read my lips, no new taxes. Well, guess what? The American people remember that. And when he broke his pledge, what happened? He wasn't reelected. He didn't get a second term. See, many people that voted for George Bush remembered that, and they believed he broke his promise. And they were right. He did break his promise. And I know he'll say he has a good reason. Today, we have the same situation in President Obama. He told the American people that they could keep their plan, keep their doctor, and under Obamacare, that their premiums for a family of four would go down by $2,500. That's what the American people heard, and that's what the American people believed, and many of them that believed it voted for him. Now they're finding out whether they have individual plans or they're covered through an employer plan whose premiums have gone up, that that's not the case. They cannot keep their plan. They cannot keep their doctor, and their premiums are going up. You see, President Obama has a credibility problem. He lied to you. No way to sugarcoat it. He lied to you. And I've said many times on this program, I followed him very early in the primaries. And what I noticed starting around September of 2008, that candidate Obama started to lie. And initially, it surprised me. But the more, if anyone that follows him and what he says, will tell you he's an habitual liar. This is not an isolated incident. Now, what's unique about this is most Americans, not all, but most Americans, just like they remember George Bush's remark, read my lips, no new taxes, they remember what Barack Obama said. And he didn't say it once. He repeated it and repeated. Even when he was elected, he repeated it. And I would say that's why he got elected both the first time and the second time. There are a lot of people that believe that. Now they're finding out they were lied to. And they're seeing their plans canceled, the premiums significantly higher, the deductibles significantly higher. And they're saying, you messed up with my life. We're talking thousands of dollars more a year in premium. And that's the so-called sticker shock. But on top of that, they're comparing the Obama Medal Plan deductibles with their current deductibles and are saying it's 5, 10, 15 times higher. And if I ever get sick, I'm going to be in trouble paying for those deductibles. So my out-of-pocket, when you measure it in terms of premiums as well as deductibles and copays, is a lot higher. So, yes, Mr. President, I have a better plan, and I'm glad all the real sick people with pre-existing conditions are covered, but A, I can't pay for the plan, and even if I can and don't and have some subsidies, I can't pay for the deductible. Yeah, I got a nice little card from my insurance company if I buy one of these plans. But what am I do when I get seriously sick and can't pay the deductible? You see, the bureaucrats, the attorneys, the arrogant elite in Washington that thinks they know better than you, they know your situation better than you, and they designed this disaster. They're elitist, and that's how they act. We know better, and what they're really saying is you're too stupid to buy what you need. So we're going to tell you what you can buy, and you better shut up and like it, and don't complain. Well, guess what? That's not the way this country runs. And I'm a big advocate of consumer sovereignty, but when someone dictates to me that I have to buy a product and limits my range of choice, I tell them, go take a hike. I will make sure that any Democrat on any ballot, whether it's city, county, state, or national, is not going to get my vote, because that party, this president, Democratic-controlled Senate and House, gave us Obamacare. I'm going to throw the bums out. How dare you mess with me and my family? How dare you restrict what I can buy? How dare you mess with my relationship with my doctors? And you need to understand this. One of the ways they're going to squeeze you is they're going to limit the doctors that you can see. They have to be in the network. And many, many doctors are not signing up for these networks. Why? They either don't know what the reimbursement schedule is, or if they do know, they know it's a loser. So you're not going to, most of you will not be able to keep your doctor. You're going to lose your plan. You're going to lose your doctor. You're going to end up spending more money. And if you ever get sick, you're going to be out a lot more money. Now, let me tell you something else that you're beginning to hear in the news. President Obama knew this. He wasn't in the dark. The bureaucrats of the IRS, Health and Human Services, were writing regulations that made it virtually impossible for you to keep your existing plan. A small example, if you change your deductible for your existing plan, that made that plan ineligible to be grandfathered. Now let me say this, I'm for competition. And if Obamacare was designed, you can truly design so you could keep what you have, both as an individual care, and through your employer. In other words, don't change the existing health insurance market. And if you wanted to add these exchangers, be my guest. I'm for more competition. I'm always for more competition, more alternatives, more choice, and your freedom of choice. That's not, Obamacare is just the first step to socialized medicine, where the government controls everything. They have an absolute monopoly, and you are dependent on that. That's what this is about. This is about control and the people in power controlling you, and one way they control you is what you can get in terms of health care. And one way they do that is what are the benefits of a so-called insurance policy, whether it's provided by an insurance company or the government. And they got you. And that's what the socialists, the collectivists are all about. It's control. How do we control the people? They don't care about your well-being. They truly don't. They want to sound like it, that this is the best thing since apple pie. What they never tell you about is how much it's going to cost you. Cost you not in just in terms of money, but also in terms of your freedom and liberty to choose a good or service that you want. It's the arrogance of power, and it's manifest in Obamacare. And you need to see the big picture. So the problems of the website are going to be solved, but the bigger problems of this is not a good product. The president can say it is and say it again and again and again, but what is the key? What are the two or three key things if you're buying health insurance? One is, and I'll say this, you would like a comprehensive health insurance plan. No argument there. But I used to sell group and individual insurance. And there's probably, I can't think of another product, there probably is, that is not more price sensitive. Whether you were buying individual coverage on your own or through coverage for your business, you are very much concerned, how much does this cost me? And it's not just the premiums, but also the deductibles, the copay, and again, what is the lifetime maximum? That's what people look for. And you're only hearing half the story. What you're not hearing, because they don't want to tell you, besides one other thing that the president kept on saying over and over and over again, if you have a pre-existing condition, you will be covered. And all the people with pre-existing, oh, great, terrific. The problem is that impacts everybody. The reason, one of the principal reason your premium is going much higher, as well as the deductible, is to pay for all those people that are in the pool that have pre-existing conditions. They're the ones that are going to be the major users of these plans. Without doubt, it's guaranteed. You can take that to the bank, and they're going to be using it. But who's going to pay for it? You are. And why I think this is going to collapse, before I move on to the last segment, is you're going to have, I think, massive adverse selection. Yeah, the people that are the sickest and that have pre-existing conditions, they will be the first to take advantage of Obamacare. And most of them will probably save money. I won't say all, but most of them will. So they'll sign up first. The poor will get their Medicaid. The near poor, or the unemployed or the part-time employed, will get a individual plan and subsidies. But the vast majority of people that were totally satisfied either with their individual plan or the employer plan are going to pay a lot, not a little, a lot more money. That's a tax. That is a tax. And what did President Obama said? If you make less than $250,000, you will not see any of your taxes go up a dime. Not your corporate tax, not your personal income tax, not your payroll taxes. None of your taxes will go up a dime. Oh, this is a tax. The Supreme Court said it's a tax. So not only have they increased your taxes, they have also increased the cost of your health insurance and limited your freedom of choice or your liberty in this area. And it's an open secret. What they truly want to do is replace this with single payer, where the government is the one that pays. Now, what's the problem with that? Because I'm sure some of you will say, and it's accurate, that one of the most popular plans today is Medicare. That's true. But what's happening to Medicare? It's going bankrupt. Bankrupt. You have unfunded liabilities for Medicare of over $80 trillion. $80 trillion. It's unsustainable. In other words, they've overpromised in Medicare. That's why Medicare and entitlements need to be reformed. Because the government literally cannot continue down this road. They don't have the money. When you cut to the chase, that's what it's all about. And what Obamacare was about is to force young people from 18 to 29 to buy insurance, knowing full well that most of them will have very little need for health care. In other words, all those premiums that young people will be paying are to subsidize older people and the sick. That, in a nutshell, is what Obamacare is about. But it's also about forcing everyone else that's older to also subsidize people that have pre-existing conditions. In other words, they're getting into your wallet. People are using the government to steal money from you, and that's what it is. It's the federal government pointing a gun at your head. And we'll fine you if you don't have a health insurance plan, and those fines will go up. Now, right now, the way the law reads or the regulations read, the only way they can collect it is if you have a refund. So you should set up your taxes so that you owe the government money at the end of the year so you don't have to pay the penalty. Now, that's some good news, but that's going to be changed. They're going to be going after your money in your bank account. So my advice for most people is, and I'm not a Republican, vote Republican to get Obamacare off the books. And I'll be the first to say there are a lot of things that the Republicans can do to improve the health insurance industry. Tort reform being one, because that's a major driver of the cost of medical care. But number two isn't competition throughout the United States, where individuals can buy policies from any insurer carrier company that offers it, not only from companies, insurance companies that are approved to sell health insurance in Texas, but throughout the United States. That would be a major reform. Actually, these two that would dramatically result in more people buying coverage and keeping coverage. There are other things that need to be done. You need to provide a tax incentive for people to buy insurance. I have mixed feelings about that, but that at least equal the tax incentive that businesses have. And I think the Republicans, I know the Republicans have a number of reforms that they would like to get passed. The problem they've had in the past is the major obstacle to that is the fact that you had a large number of Democrats and progressives, or progressive Democrats, that wanted single payer. And if they couldn't get single payer, they were willing to settle for Obamacare. What's disturbing is this is a precedent in the sense that the government is telling you what you have to buy. It's a dangerous precedent. It needs to be overturned just because of that. Not because there are many things to improve the health insurance in terms of competition, in terms of incentives that can and should be implemented. And what the Republicans need to do is market their alternatives. I've heard very little, if any, Republicans saying, okay, here's what we stand for. Here's what we would do. That's what they need to do, and they're not doing. It's all negative. And I can understand it. They need to eliminate Obamacare. Defund it, repeal it, replace it. But you got to tell people what you're going to replace it with. And that, I think, is where the Republicans have fallen short. Remember, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I think the federal government isn't way too big. And if you don't believe me, just look at the national debt, over $17 trillion. You add unfunded liabilities, the real numbers are like over $120 trillion, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And they're playing some games with the numbers. I'm not going to get into that. Now, I want to at least cover Benghazi. What happened this week, two things happened. One, 60 Minutes did a report, and I urge you to listen. It's about a 16-minute segment. That came up with a little new information, but not a lot, because if you really follow Benghazi, you knew most, if not all, of it. But they had one gentleman that didn't give his name for, I think, his security, but they had him on camera and made the point that when he was hired to do security at the CIA annex and for the State Department, the first thing he noticed when he toured Benghazi, when he got to Benghazi, was the fact that Al-Qaeda flags were flying in the city in many places. That's disturbing. That would disturb me. And then when he got to the compound, there was no one outside. There were no patrols. They were having tea, and they were unarmed. Benghazi is in one of the top 10 locations in terms of danger, for example, for State Department employees, for a city to be in. You don't particularly want to go to Benghazi, or for that matter, Tripoli, because you might get killed or injured. And many Americans got killed. Four Americans were killed, including Ambassador Stevens, but also seven were seriously wounded. So you had a little breaking news in the 60-minute report. They also interviewed Greg Hicks and I think it's Andrew or Andy Wood. Now, Hicks was the charge d'affaires, the number two guy in Tripoli, and the last one to talk to Ambassador Chris Stevens when he was alive over the phone. Remember, Stevens was in a so-called diplomatic facility or compound in Benghazi. He was attacked, and the last one in Tripoli to talk to him was Hicks. And he was told by Hicks, we're under attack. And a little bit after that, the connection was broken, and in less than 24 hours, it was learned that Ambassador Stevens died of asphyxiation when there was a planned, organized assault on that diplomatic facility. They burnt it out, and it was the fire and the smoke that resulted in two people being killed at that diplomatic facility, the other being a State Department employee. And here's the sad part. It was very clear from this report and other reports that there was no attempt by the United States government to try to send military assets to rescue them. Now, I'm of the opinion that it's doubtful, because they were not close by. It would be probably several hours at best before they could get any assets in the area. But here's the point. even though Ambassador Stevens and the State Department employee would have died, you didn't know how long this attack would last. And no attempt was made to save the people at that facility. And what's even worse, the CIA ordered its own people, as did the State Department, that were in the so-called CIA annex that were several blocks away from this diplomatic facility, not to send any assistance. Yet several people, two of who subsequently died, went to the rescue of the people that were under attack at the diplomatic facility, rescue them, and had to go to the annex the process of driving to it was attacked, their vehicles were attacked, and then subsequently when they got to the annex with the wounded as well as the ones that were mobile, two of these Navy SEALs, former Navy SEALs that were hired for security were on the roof and got killed by mortar fire. Very accurate and deadly mortar fire. Ladies and gentlemen, this was a planned attack, and all that information was known in Washington, D.C. at the time of the attack or shortly thereafter. It had absolutely nothing to do with the so-called vile, insulting YouTube video that insulted the believers of Islam. That was the so-called cover story. And that is what you heard from former or then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, as well as the president, when the remains of the four people that were killed in Benghazi were returned to the United States 3 days later. They blamed all of this on a video, on a spontaneous demonstration caused by viewing this YouTube video. That was a complete lie, an utter lie. It was a cover story. It wasn't true. It was meant to deceive the American people before the election. Because the theme at the Democratic Convention just days before is that Al-Qaeda was on the run. They had killed bin Laden, and Al-Qaeda is on the run. They weren't on the run. They were planning and executed attacks. They first attacked the Red Cross and the British ambassador prior to the attack on the U.S. facility. And then they killed our own ambassador. There have only been six ambassadors in our entire history that have been killed. The last was over three decades ago. It's rare. And usually when they're attacked, help is sent by our military. But no help was sent by our military. Someone, namely the commander-in-chief, issued orders not to send help. They were told to stand down. Several generals were relieved of command because they wanted to send help and were told in no uncertain terms not to. Don't interfere. And Americans died. Four Americans died, including the ambassador. Seven were seriously injured, some very, very much injured. Fortunately, the people at the CIA annex were assisted by some not military, but State Department employees that came from Tripoli and were able to get the people out of the CIA annex onto an airplane and eventually out of the country. But there was no military response. There was no CIA response. There are a lot of unanswered questions. The biggest one, what was the CIA doing in Benghazi? It was clear it was a covert operation. That's what the cover-up is all about. That's what they don't want to be examined in detail. Now, my suspicion, but other people have said this, what the CIA was doing in Benghazi was gathering up weapons as well as fighters to be sent or transported to Turkey, ultimately to be sent to Syria. And you got to remember, Gaddafi was in power for over 42 years, had arms caches at all his military bases, multiple sites, several on each base. And many of those weapons were, those lockers, those buildings, those warehouses were broken into, and many of those weapons were stolen or taken by the Libyan rebels, many of them with links to Al-Qaeda. And what the CIA was trying to do was first gather those weapons with the goal or aim of transporting them again to Syria rebels that were fighting Assad. That's what they're covering up. That's what they really don't want to be looked at. That's why they're making it literally impossible for both CIA and some State Department employees, contract employees, to come forward, the so-called survivors of the Benghazi attack, and testify in front of Congress. In other words, the United States government is covering up this CIA operation. They don't want it exposed. Now, why? What do they don't want the American people to know? If you listen to several of my past shows, there were between 10,000 and 20,000 shoulder-mounted surface-to-air missiles that Gaddafi had bought primarily from the former Soviet Union as well as Russia. These weapons are very accurate. They have a limited range of about 10 to 12,000 feet in terms of altitude. But they're very deadly in bringing down aircraft, military aircraft, including fighters, transports, helicopters, and airlines. Someone equipped with these surface-to-air missiles, shoulder-mounted, could bring down an airliner. And what they didn't want the American people aware of, that one of the consequences of the Libyan civil war, that some of the so-called bad guys, the jihadists, the Al-Qaeda, that want to kill Americans, got a hold of these weapons. Not only the surface-to-air missiles, but a whole slew of weapons. And the fear is that one or more of these surface-air missiles, probably many, could find their way either into Europe or into the United States, and then subsequently shoot down an airliner in flight. You know, the best time to do it is when an airliner is either taking off or landing. Actually, the best time is when they're taking off. So you sit in a warehouse near where an airport is, pop up, shoot it, and one less airline. That's the fear. And they don't want the American people to know that. They don't. That's the major scandal of Benghazi. That's what they don't want to be talked about. The fact that the CIA was engaged in a covert operation to ship arms and supplies to the rebels in Syria, including such weapons as shoulder-mounted weapons. And now the majority of those Syrian rebels, unfortunately, are radical jihadists, Al-Qaeda-related. Al-Nusra is one of the biggest ones. And we're shipping weapons to them? See, that's the scandal. And before an election, that is absolutely the last thing you want to hear on the news. Because I tell you something, if the media had done its job, were aggressive, and they could have done their job, but they didn't. And this came out, do you think President Obama would be president today? I don't. I truly don't. And part of the problem is the Republican candidate, another progressive, by the way, a collectivist, nice guy, smart, but he's another big government type. He's a statist. He could got elected and I think would be at war with Syria and Iran, or both, today. I'm not saying Romney was any better. I did not support Romney. But I don't think President Obama would be commander-in-chief today. So the combination of the cover story lying to the American people and the fact that the press didn't do its job, the three major networks, the exception being Fox, they didn't aggressively pursue it. Now, some working at some of those stations did. There are some exceptions to this broad accusation. Now, almost a year from the last election, or a week, you know, we're 51 weeks later, they have a report on CBS 60 Minutes, providing probably more detail in one story than most Americans were aware a year before. Yet most, if not all, of that information could have been made known to the American people in the September, October, early November timeframe of last year. And it would be dangerous to go to Benghazi to get that information. You see, ladies and gentlemen, what the U.S. government has done is try to make sure that the people either working for the CIA or the State Department, either as employees or contractors, do not go to the press. And second, do not testify in front of any of the oversight committees in the House and the Senate. That's the game they're playing. That they're stonewalling. And there were 35-plus people at the CIA annex. Most of those people were CIA employees. Remember, this was a CIA covert operation done, I believe, because I don't have access to this, at the specific direction of the president. He signed a secret finding that the CIA would, one of the things that they would do is this mission, this covert operation or action. It wasn't supposed to see the light of day. That's when this attack was successful. And they attacked both the diplomatic facility where two Americans, including the ambassador, were killed. And then they attacked the CIA, so-called CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, an annex in Benghazi, where they were accumulating these weapons. That was never to be exposed in the press. And what happened is the attack forced the press to look at it. You got to explain, why did four Americans die? Why did we have 35 or more CIA and State Department employees over there? Remember, this is a very dangerous place to work. It's not a walk in the park. There are people there today, as they were a year ago, that if they ever could get a hold of an American and knew you were American, and even worse, knew you work for the government, especially the CIA, would slit your throat, would kill you. They'll torture you, try to get as much information out of you, and then kill you. And what was very clear in the CIA report from the colonel, lieutenant colonel, that they actually shipped home a month prior to the attack on Benghazi, who warned them, you're going to be attacked. You know, he told them, Al-Qaeda on websites have indicated they're going to attack the Red Cross, the British, and us. We have to change our so-called security profile. That's another way to say we got to move. We either got to get out of Dodge, get out of Benghazi completely, or move. Because people are the enemy, Al-Qaeda, and several of the militant organizations that fought in the Civil War. They knew that the Benghazi diplomatic facility, as well as the CIA, was the next target. It was a planned, organized, professionally done attack, and they were successful. Four Americans died, seven got wounded, and what was the United States government's response? They did nothing. Nothing. Neither the CIA or the U.S. military did nothing. And that only happens, ladies and gentlemen, if the President of the United States says stand down. Because the standing orders are to move assets towards the problem and to rescue the people. Those are the standing orders. So those orders had to be stopped. And only the President of the United States can do it. That's why both people in the Senate and in the House are demanding that the people that were at Benghazi, the so-called survivors, both of the CIA and the State Department, appear and testify in public as to what exactly happened during those 24 hours. Why were they there? What was their mission? And this should be in public testimony. In public testimony. Why? Because the American people were lied to by the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, as well as the United Nations ambassador. Willful deception of the American people to cover up what happened, both why the CIA was there and the fact that no attempt was made to provide help to the people that were being attacked, not only at the diplomatic facility, but also at the CIA annex. And what I think is going to happen in the next 30 to 60 days, let's put it this way, what I hope happens is that someone or several, well, we have at least 50 GOP or Republicans that have signed a letter demanding that these 35 survivors of Benghazi be forced to testify, and they will be getting subpoenas. They will be getting subpoenas. You see, here's the problem. I'm aware that there are several of the people that were there that would like to testify, but they're not going to do it unless they're forced to do it by subpoena. What this administration is doing is stonewalling. They're first of all trying to intimidate the people that were there by making them sign non-disclosure agreements, as well as taking lie detector tests periodically to make sure they don't talk to the press. They're trying to scare you. They're basically telling you, shut up. Don't you dare go to the press. Don't you dare go to Congress. Now, the powers that be, the CIA director will say, I'm willing to let them testify. But do you think if you have a career on the line with the CIA or State Department that you're going to just waltz in and do that? Yeah, there are occasionally you'll get a whistleblower. No, the only way these people will ever testify in public is they're going to have to be subpoenaed. They're going to have to be found. My understanding, the Congress doesn't even know these people's names or whereabouts. And they're deliberately being hidden from the Congress. Several oversight committees are looking into this. And one of the problem with these investigations is you have various committees doing this, which is a bad idea. I don't usually agree with Senator Lindsey Graham, but I do here. We need a joint, which means Senate and House, special investigation of this, where you have counsel, both a majority and minority counsel, to ask the questions. You see, if you've listened to any of these oversight committees, whether it's Darrell Issa's committee that's doing an excellent job, or other senators, the Senate Intelligence Committee or the House Intelligence Committee, you got two problems. One, a lot of the testimony is not done in public. Initially, they will be interviewed by the staff. I understand that. And then a few will give testimony for the public to hear. The problem is what's happening, because of the leadership both in the House and the Senate, is they can stovepiping. That's another word to say the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. And the problem with these committees is you have a number of people on the committees, both Democrats and Republicans, that get 5 minutes to ask a question. So you get a lot of random questions, disconnected questions. That's not what we need. What we need is a counsel or attorney with a staff of investigators, as well as other attorneys, questioning all these people, as well as looking at the documents, and then bringing these people in front of a joint committee where, just like it's like the Watergate Committee, that would be the closest I would say. And ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States does not want this to happen. That's why they're stonewalling and dragging their feet and being totally uncooperative. I will quote Senator Graham, because Wolf Blitzer asked him, well, what has the White House told you? And the senator was completely candid. Take a hike. And if that's their attitude, the only way you're going to get their attention is you're going to have a special investigating committee, ideally joint, hire counsel, and subpoena. That's the only way you're going to get to the bottom of it. And the problem is the leadership, both in the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, do not want that to happen. Do not want that to happen. That's what's going on. The American people were lied to. And like I said, if the media had been doing its job, I suspect that President Obama would not be president today. Unfortunately, they weren't doing their job. They ran away from this story. They wanted no part of it. Very, very few reporters really dug in. And even if they did, most of them were pro-Obama. And they knew this could hurt his chances of re-election. And they were absolutely right. It would hurt his chance of re-election. I think it would destroy it. If, there's a big if here, the Republican candidate Romney had made this an issue. He didn't. He would not really go after President Obama. He was afraid they might call him a racist. So he didn't. He did not make this an issue. They focused in on unemployment, which I understand, and it didn't resonate. See, as far as I'm concerned, any president that's been president for 4 years with unemployment rates above 7%, it got as high as 10%. His economic policies, if the trend is not significantly improved, doesn't deserve a second term. And keep in mind, if Romney had gotten the same number of votes as John McCain got in the previous election, where John McCain lost, Romney would be president today. And the reason Romney did not get that is conservatives and libertarians stayed home. they were not going to vote for a progressive Republican. They stayed home, and we have Obama. I didn't vote for either of them because I'm not a Democrat nor a Republican, because there's not much difference between either party. Now, there are people in the Republican Party that I would support, such as Ted Cruz, Rand Paul, Mike Lee, and there are people in the Congress as well. But unfortunately, they're the exception, and their numbers hopefully will grow. But I don't see much change happening in the Republican Party. You see, the Republican Party, very much like the Democratic Party, in terms of its leadership, has been captured by many people that are closet progressives. They might talk conservative, but they're not. They're for big government. They're for big interventionist government status. And see, that's the common theme, both in terms of Obamacare and the Benghazi, what I would call scandal. They're both about interventionism. One is domestic intervention in the health insurance market, and the other is government intervention abroad. And they both have a bad ending, because I don't favor either Obamacare, nor do I favor the government intervention in Libya that resulted in Benghazi. It's simple. It's none of the government's business what health insurance I buy. And I certainly don't want them to design it, because they'll screw up. And they've screwed up big time here. And I don't want government intervention abroad in my name, because it invariably costs the lives of many Americans as well as national treasure. And I certainly do not want the CIA to be shipping arms and fighters to Syrian rebels, many of them who are al-Qaeda affiliated, that want to kill us. I say, are you out of your mind? And see, that's what happened when that's what happens when you have people in both Congress and in the White House that think they know best. They think they're smart. They think they're the best and brightest. It's the arrogance of power. And who gets hurt? The American people gets hurt. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We are the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of anyone at KDUX, Richland College, or the DCCD. Thank you for listening. I hope it's been both informative, educational, and a little bit entertaining. And do your homework. Now, back to the music. Have a great day. Goodbye.